This podcast is brought to you by Rain Barrel. Rain Barrel is a cookieless consented audience graph that helps advertisers interact with their best fit customers. Digital advertising shouldn't be a black box, which is why Rain Barrel was created by media buyers for media buyers. With over 12,000 public audiences, Rain Barrel has helped renowned brands like a large golf retailer explode their campaign reach by millions just by tapping into the right audience for golf course and country club visitors. Try out Rain Barrel audiences on DV360, The Trade Desk, LiveRamp, and beyond, or learn more at rbarrel.com. That's rbarrel.com. Welcome to the Marketecture Podcast. I'm Ari Papero. I'm joined today by Eric Franchi and Kim Isana. Insana, sorry if I mispronounced that, who is the founder of Always On Digital and a longtime veteran of our industry. So, Kim, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Some housekeeping. So this week's vendor interview is with Innovid, where David Helmreich came on and talked about their new products as well as their existing products and TV Squared. It's a very interesting conversation, and that's free from the paywall until Monday. And starting next week, the vendor interviews are going to be a special series in conjunction with the IAB Tech Lab. The IAB Tech Lab is having its 10th anniversary. And so we partnered to have in-depth interviews on each of their major accomplishments, including the VAST standard, which I'm being interviewed on, the measurement standards, OpenRTB. It's really interesting if you're into ad tech. Next 4 or 5 weeks, you'll have those special episodes. All right, let's dive right in. So, Kim, you've been, I think, in ad tech longer than I have, maybe longer than Eric has. So that's saying something.
She's shaking her head no.
No, I started 25 years ago in digital. And truth be told, even though I started in radio, I was working through high school and college. So that helps from an age perspective of how long
child
ago
labor,
I started,
selling the ads.
Yeah.
Wait, you were selling ads in high school?
It was my after school job to work at Interrupt. I went to school, high school in the city. So I got a job there after school when I was 15. So I started doing, you know, confirmations where you were fax the orders and then I'd have to call and confirm. And then I started ghostwriting, you know, orders and deals at one point. So I learned the space pretty early. I actually had to take off to graduate from college because
that's unbelievable.
I had started at Value Click and I needed to ask for a day off to go to my graduation. So I did start ahead of the game. I always thought that I was the youngest in the industry. And then now I look back and I'm like, oh, I'm not so young anymore compared to everybody else.
So you took off from Value Click to go to your high school graduation.
Yep. I took off from Value Click to go to my college.
College. Okay.
At that point. But I did have to probably take off from Interrupt to go to my high school graduation as well.
That's amazing. So for non-OGs, Value Click became Conversant, which became Epsilon, which became Publicis.
Yep.
Did I have that right?
While I was there, I think they acquired 12 different companies at the time.
That's like right.
Click agents, web clients.
Commission Junction.
There was a lead company in there. I forget what it was called.
And obviously Fast Click.
Where
you were focused on when we first met too many years ago.
So how did that journey turn into you running an agency? So you're the CEO of Always On Digital, which is an agency, right? A digital agency. So how did that happen?
Yeah. So we're actually a digital and traditional. We had pivoted in 2020. So we do offer all types of services and we work with brands and agencies. So even if there's agencies involved, we kind of just pick up and handle execution and things like that for them. But it wasn't something that I had sought out it wasn't one of my dreams as a little girl to start a business. It was more need-based. I was at Akamai and our division ended up getting bought out by MediaMath. And so when we made the change, one of the things that happened when we fully rolled into MediaMath in 2013 was that we were going to move to the World Trade Center. And personally, I'm in Long Island. I had 3 kids at the time, got 4 now. And my commute was about 2 hours each way. So it was really tough. They really weren't into the work from home thing. Some of us were allowed. I was fortunate enough to have some work from home, but most of my team was not. And so what I started to see happen as people had babies, you know, so it was particularly moms, obviously, but as people had babies, they started just to leave. And it was, you know, generally our most senior traders, our most senior account managers, you know, the folks that you could really trust and rely on. Also, what happened was we used to have weekend hours for trading and Well, that may not seem important. We all know that things happen. Unfortunately, there's plane crashes, there's, you know, bad news or pixels fall off. Things happen on weekends. Black Friday is such a big deal for retail advertisers. So what ended up happening is that went away. And my team had some big accounts that ended up losing out with not having those weekend hours. One of our clients at the time was Joseph A. Bank. Their pixel fell off on Black Friday.
Oh my God.
It was a nightmare and nobody was working. So at the end of the day, I went to Josie and I was like, you help all these people start businesses. You know, what about me? Can I take these folks that don't seem to fit here, mainly moms at the time? And then also there's business that doesn't seem like it's the right fit here either, because at that time we were trying to move everybody to self-serve. And so Adroit really was a managed service business. So it was a little bit different. And I said, you know, I could do the IO stuff or deals that are too small for Media Math. Could you help me get started? And Joe was wonderful. He was like, yeah, you know, him and Mike Lamb were like, give us some time, but let's, you know, we'll try to figure something out. And the figuring it out ended up being me being part of a layoff, which I didn't know at the time that that was the plan. I found out after. They're like, you know, here we go. Now you can start your business. So I started in April of 2016. We've been around for 8 years. The irony of it is about a year ago, my team's like, hey, can we get an office? Because we've been apart for so many years and we get together here and there, but they're like, it'd be cool to get together more often. And especially as their some of their lives have evolved, their kids are all in school now and they've just, you know, things have shifted. So we ended up getting an office out here in Long Island over a year ago so that we can connect more in person. But it's been a fun journey. Like I said, it wasn't something I had thought out to do. I found out after we hit year five that most businesses fail in the first 5 years. So that was a surprise. Thank goodness I didn't know before, because really what you don't know is way better. You know, ignorance is bliss.
So you really were remote before it was cool to be remote, before COVID, several years before COVID. How did it affect your ability to hire and the types of people you hired?
So there are some really great organizations that help you hire working mothers in particular. But to be honest, I just had my connections. One of our sweet spots is that point at which someone has their second kid and they realize, this is going to be a little harder for me to commute and do this, daycare, things like that. So in that sense, we've had people just come to us. And I've hired people that were at Media Math. One of the people that work with us on our team, she's been with me since the Akamai days. So we've worked together, I think, at this point, 14 years. So we have a, you know, we have a longstanding team. It's been easy to hire in that sense, people that we know, or then using other organizations that help you find, you know, either working parents or mothers. We actually have a dad that works
with us.
Actually
have a dad.
Huh? We actually have a dad. We have a couple
dads. Diversity.
But he wanted a life change, wanted to do this. We knew his wife and they actually both worked with us for a little while. And then he came and he's doing great. He's one of our best traders. So, you know, sometimes about giving people a chance that may not fit the mold, and especially if you're not right out of college.
So are you just like hanging out on Instagram looking for the baby photos, then you just slide into the DMs like, hey, looking for a change of pace? I see you got a second baby.
I have to wait till they go back to work.
Right, 3 months. You put a ticker.
So you have to wait till they're back at work, because if they're not, they have to experience the pain. That's where it comes from, you know, and they have the pain.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you was around employee development. Right. Because one of the things that I'm seeing is for companies that, you know, started during the pandemic, you know, started by necessity, fully remote, and now they're scaling, you know, there's a desire to have people in the office more, because as they're scaling, they're hiring more junior employees. Those employees, sometimes this is their first job. They need to know how to work. So I guess you answered the question along the way, which is, you're not necessarily hiring those types of employees that might require in-office collaboration, learning, mentoring. You're hiring folks with experience that can hop right in and put hands on keyboard. Do I have that right?
So it depends on what the role is for. For something that's trading and very specific, generally we need somebody who has experience, because you got to jump right in. Our clients tend to be ones that come last minute with something or something very quick. So there isn't a huge opportunity for a learning curve unless you started with us early on. However, for roles that are, you know, social media oriented, content writing, things like that, we do hire people that are newer and more junior, where they need more hands-on training and stuff like that. And then once they're with us, yes, they can try to go into those roles. There is a challenge, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, because I have a child that's going into college, is going to have a job. His whole desire is to start his own business. And I'm like, you have to work somewhere. You can't just start a business out of college. You have to experience a terrible boss. You have to experience a great boss. I mean, that's how we learn. We learn more from failures and bad situations sometimes than better ones. And you have to have that collaboration. So if it's not in person, there has to be so much, you know, Zoom time and Google Meets, because otherwise you're not learning. But there is just something to be said with, you know, you're hearing from the cube next door what's going on, or you're invited to a meeting that you wouldn't have been invited to otherwise just because you're walking by. So it is a challenge. And it isn't generally, you know, like I said, unfortunately, we cannot just hire folks that are brand new without understanding that we have to really invest the time in. And I don't think it's fair to them. So we pick and choose carefully. So the majority of our hires aren't like that, but we do have two folks on our team that are just more junior.
So it sounds like you kind of empathize with the bosses out there who are saying return to the office is important for young people and for certain types of collaboration and creativity.
Absolutely. And I know it's odd because that's not what the company, you know, initially started as, but I believe in it because I think it is important. And even just for us to learn, we have, you know, I spend a lot of time selling and doing things and working with clients, but I also have to spend a good amount of time talking to other businesses because we miss out on learnings that you would have had in a bigger organization. When I was at MediaMath, there was constant learning because somebody was in charge of, you know, just reading articles all day and all that. Like, you don't always have that. So you have to talk to other business owners. I think I have pretty good relationships with a lot of people that are in competitive spaces, other companies or even, you know, SSPs or DSPs. And then I, you know, continuously talk to them as well, because you need that, because we don't have it in person. We have to work harder at it to have those relationships and those learnings.
So can you give us a sense of some of the ways in which you make your organization effective as a remote organization? Do you give them special equipment? Do you expect certain check-ins, off-sites, anything you could tell us about how you make it work?
So we probably speak every day on video at some point. So we have a team call, but there's usually a quick video call throughout the day, or email. We use Slack, a chat all the time. So there's constant communication, almost as if you are together. But in terms of, you know, special equipment, nothing really in particular, other than, you know, their standard laptop and cell phone. And then we try to get together as frequently as possible, but we also try to respect what their balance is. So in the summer, sometimes it's harder because, you know, folks may have their kids home part of the day, or, you know, I have kids that are in travel baseball, and that's a nightmare, to be honest. So, I mean, I've got to go, my whole summer is ruined. I got to go to Cooperstown. I got to drop a kid at college. I'm this, you know, so life happens. So a lot of times we, you know, we try to fit it in where we can, the in-persons, but, you know, we were purpose driven.
You never sort of told the origin story about the why you called it Always On Digital. Was the inspiration that whole lack of weekend coverage, you know, Black Friday pixel, like, hey, I see a gap in the market for just, you know, constant coverage. Is that the reason for the name?
Yeah. So that's, okay. And it's not a recommended name. I will tell you that. If I had to do it again, maybe you don't want to call it that, because people do call you all the time. But no, it's okay. The reality is, yes, it was the weekend coverage. It was the nighttime coverage. But I also found myself, you know, I would leave work and then, you know, do the kid stuff and do dinner or do practice homework. And then I would go back on at night and I would work for another 2 to 3 hours, like most of us do. And, you know, one, that makes your cost per hour a lot lower than, you know, what it is. Your salary doesn't look as good when you're working all these hours, but that's the reality. And I felt like it's okay to tell people, I'm taking a break between these times and I'm going to be back on later. Don't worry, the work will get done. I think there was just such a stigma about it. You know, 8 years ago when I was trying to do it, like, it was like, oh, you know, you're not going to have a call at 3 o'clock. No, I'm not. and I don't take, you know, but I'll take a call at 6 or 6:30. Right. I have no problem with that because we, you know, we try to work that. So that's why it is ends up being always on.
But that said, how much, so I'm just curious about the work. Are you still seeing this need in the market for like constant coverage, you know, flexible coverage? And is that, you know, continuing to be an area where you've got differentiation?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, if you send an email at 4 o'clock on a Friday, you don't really want the response Monday morning at 9. You want the response Friday or Saturday or Sunday. And so there's certain things we'll do on the weekends and there's certain things we won't. We don't turn campaigns on a Friday or on the weekend. And that's because other people are not working. So if something goes wrong, we don't have somebody that's going to help us or respond. But we do check-ins on the weekend. I'm not saying my team works all day on the weekends. They do weekend checks, make sure CPMs didn't go off the rail, like this, you know, a pixel didn't drop off, there's not a problem with spend. Because as much as we rely on technology, the human has to check it at the end of the day. And so I do feel there's a need because stuff happens all the time still that we see on the weekends. So I'd be afraid to stop having that coverage.
With the flexible schedule and the, you know, having to travel during the summer and all of that, are you paying market rates and are you paying on a salary or are you adjusting for hours that may not be work?
Everybody has a different situation. Some people are, you know, salaried. Some folks are part-time and then paid hourly and then, you know, due by time cards. It really depends on what the individual is looking for. So we have that conversation. It's not your traditional, we're hiring for this role and this is what it is. You know, some people only have 30 hours a week to give and they'll just do a time card. We do pay market rates. We do not hire internationally. It is something that has made us lose business, you know, but that wasn't our purpose. You know, if I have a, you know, a working mom or a working dad or a working person that wants to travel and have a flexible lifestyle, and I'm committed to them, I'm not going to go and pay someone $8 an hour in another country and then they not have that opportunity. If I could give them that opportunity, I would like to. And I don't knock the companies that do make these choices. Obviously, that's their own business. But that's just kind of what we set out to do.
Right. So Always On is sort of purpose-driven in this regard. What advice would you have for a CEO or a manager who's listening to this, who's, you know, part of a ordinary organization and wants to help bring gender equity to the workplace and have more diversity in the workplace?
So sometimes you have to trust people. And I've been in situations where I haven't been trusted. Not for any reason that I shouldn't have been trusted, but there's the bosses that are out there that just feel like if you're not on IM and it doesn't say active the whole time, that you're not working. And that's not the truth. You know, the proof is in the numbers. In a sales job, it's super easy, right? You don't hit your goal.
Was that just an AIM reference?
It was an AIM reference. Yes. You know, or you got to shake the mouth. I mean, now people are smart. They figure out those like mouth shaker things or whatever, but like, I can't even imagine doing that at this point. You know, if I can't trust the folks that work for me, they shouldn't work for me. That's it. The same thing for anyone else. Like, you have to let go of certain things. I have 4 kids. And when I had 1 kid, maybe my house, you know, was cleaner and I could be tougher on things. But as that number grew, I had to let go of certain things. And it's the same thing. You know, you have to let go of some stuff.
All right. I think that's a great place to end the conversation. Let's take a quick break and talk about the news of the week, including the big news from Trade Desk and Roku and Google earnings and a bunch of other stuff. This podcast is brought to you by Innovid and their Harmony Initiative. Innovid believes that TV should be open for everyone and controlled by no one. And the time to make that vision a reality is now. That's why Innovid created Harmony, an industry-wide initiative to address the biggest challenges facing CTV advertising today. By optimizing at the infrastructure level, Harmony aims to improve efficiency, enhance transparency and control, and increase ROI, all while reducing carbon emissions and providing better viewing experiences for all. Find out more and get involved at innovid.com/harmony.
And we're back. So big news week. Feels like it's been a big news week, like every week for 2024. We'll start off with earnings. So seems like the big platforms report first. And some of the second-tier platforms, but first in our heart, report next week. So we'll probably have another week of this. Anyway, the big ones were Google, which we had end of last week after we recorded, and Amazon just this week. And both did great. So Google, overall revenue up 15% to $80.54 billion, just a huge business. And YouTube is clearly the star for the advertising business, up 21% year over year to $8.1 billion. I think the one thing that's interesting in that is what is not going well is the network business. So the network business continues to decline. Last year, it was $7.5 billion, and this year, it was $7.4 billion. While presumably the trend of TTD, PubMatic, Viant, they continue to all grow in the open web. So Google is officially losing share in a market that they've dominated for the longest
time.
Yeah,
I wrote about this in my newsletter pretty extensively last week. And then Eric Seufert, in his newsletter, said the Google network is a vestigial organ, which was, you know, putting it a little more harshly. I'll just kind of quickly summarize some of the thoughts around the world around this. So Eric's point is that the open web is dying and that Google's network business was built at a time when the web was everything and it's all switched and now it's all app and people spend most of their time in apps and the open web business is just sitting there attriting more or less. And I think that's true, but not the whole story, because the other part of the story is that Google uses the open web as a way to create liquidity for the products where they make more money. And in particular, you have a product like PMax, which tells the advertiser, just give us your money and we'll work it out. And so the fact that the network is part of that business allows them to have more scale so that they can divert the highest margin, highest priced ads to YouTube. So I think that theory holds some water that if they were, for example, not just to shut down the network business, that would hurt YouTube. And YouTube is the growth engine and is high margin and is et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of different thoughts about this. I also made the point that, you know, it's not a coincidence that the network business grew every year until Neil Mohan switched to YouTube, and then YouTube started growing. So shout out to Neil Mohan for being the man with the golden touch.
Absolutely. Kim, do you, and you don't have to comment on this if you don't want to, do you use some of these AI tools that are driving a lot of growth like PMax as part of your overall media mix?
So our search is probably limited in terms of how much we run compared to the other channels, maybe 10 to 15%. We've dabbled with PMax. I haven't seen amazing results for some of it. And I think maybe, you know, it could be the type of clients we have. Some of our search clients are more local. So we find other things, you know, some of the local targeting that we implement or just better keywords work better. For newer clients, the PMax has been okay. It's just when it's been somebody who's been running for a while to make some changes, sometimes that engine is just working and it doesn't make sense to adjust too much for us. But, you know, we do use YouTube quite a bit, but just, you know, Google search, anything open web for Google is more on the smaller scale.
Yep, absolutely. The other big earnings announcement was Amazon. In our show notes, I basically, you know, said a beast. So ad revenue up 24% year over year to $11.82 billion. So between their core business and the change that they made earlier this year, i.e. adding ads to Prime Video, it's just printing money. So the overall revenue for Amazon was $143.3 billion, up 11% year over year. But, you know, it's you know, still the growth and the profit is coming from Amazon ads. And the highest growth driver of that is Amazon Video. And it seems like they're continuing to double down on this stuff.
Yeah, we talked about how they brought on Krishan from NBC. It's a big move. And I think this week, we didn't have it in the show notes, but there's a lot of talk about them buying some of the NBA rights in the renegotiation. So having, you know, that high quality video and the ad sales force and the ad tech all together, plus the sports, it's a pretty exciting situation over there.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, a beast. Back to Google. So closing arguments in the Google antitrust trial are today.
Yeah, this is a big deal. This is antitrust trial number one, the search trial. And the government is asking for restrictions on the ability to buy preferential placement in browsers in Apple, et cetera. We've talked about this before. So there's two ways to look at this. On the one hand, you say, oh my God, this is the golden goose. If more people change their defaults in the search engine, that would be a huge hit to Google. And then the other point of view is like, actually, this will help Google because they'll still be the default because everyone knows their brand and they won't have to pay for it anymore. I'm kind of in the second camp. And I tweeted this the other day, like I've never been more wrong more consistently about anything in my entire life than being bearish on Google. So I'm just tired of saying anything bad's going to happen to Google. They're going to be around forever. We're all eventually work for them. They'll change the name of the planet from Earth to Google. Like that's where I'm at now.
Kim, do you have a position on that last point? Because I want to talk about something related in a sec.
I kind of agree. I think, you know, as much as anything, they're gonna still be around. We rely on them too much, especially as we start to, you know, with the sign-ins and your Google Photos and everything else. People are not going to make changes because it's easy, especially when you forget what your password is and you can sign in with Google and you can do this. Like, you're just giving all your information away. You're telling everybody what you're doing. And so it just keeps adding to their power. And I'm guilty of it, so I'm not judging.
Yes. So last week, Ari and I were at this Ad Tech Economic Forum. And it was awesome. It was a great day. I was on a panel and the moderator was Brian O'Kelly. And Brian, if you know him, you know, he loves to mix it up. And he ended the panel with a curveball. He asked us, and this was all VCs, so we all, you know, kind of, you know, try to, you know, have contrarian views. He asked us what percentage of search we think would be Google search in a decade. And the other panelists had, like, I think very well reasoned, you know, responses, 60%, 80%. And then he threw it to me. And I thought for a second and I said zero. And I don't believe that zero is going to be the number. The point is, I think that we need to believe that, you know, massive change can happen. Before the iPhone, did we ever think that we would have a device that, you know, essentially was like the system of record for everything that we do? No, right? Perplexity is a far better search engine than Google, like full stop. It's not lined with ads. It's, you know, really, really high quality experience. I think we need to believe that Google can lose their position and be completely usurped. And maybe that's because I need to believe as a course of doing my job.
My thought on it is that the only thing that will disrupt Google is if people stop searching. If there's some new way in which people get information.
Exactly.
And that leap, whatever that is technologically, could disrupt them from at least a big portion of what they do right now.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people think that the entire web experience is going to change. And maybe, Kim, your point today is like super valid. Like, you know, we depend on these companies for the single sign-on and everything like that. But what happens if everything changes? And I think there's a non-zero chance of that happening. So that's a sort of, you know, more aggressive contrarian outlook that, hey, we need to believe that change can happen as it has in the past. Anyway, off the soapbox.
It can happen. I mean, think about TikTok, right? We thought Facebook was the end-all be-all. And then here comes this TikTok app and look at it now. And so it's not that something can't come in, but it has to be different and better and easier, especially if people use something that's comfortable and easy for them. It's got to be way better. And to your point, right, did we think everything in this iPhone was going to be there? No, we didn't think phones, you know, in that sense. I had a BlackBerry and it had some texting and stuff. That was cool, you know, or the walkie-talkie Nextel. But this, you know, it has to be better. And just with any app that's come out, it isn't always just new is not always better.
Yep. Got you. New fronts. As an agency, did you do anything around the new fronts? Did you attend anything, Kim?
We do spend a lot of our time more in the diversity space and have done that. So we've actually stayed away from the traditional, like non-digital traditional new fronts.
Gotcha. Yeah, I poked around a little bit and had a few meetings. Seems like it was great. The biggest announcement was probably this TTD Roku thing, where effectively Roku, you know, for the first time, is putting their data, you know, the audience data and the ACR data, into the trade desk so buyers can use the data to, you know, better do their streaming buys. This is a real departure for Roku, who was not doing this previously. So I think it sort of signals probably a change of strategy, you know, led by Jay Eskenazi, who's amazing former Undertone exec. And then also just further, you know, sort of strengthening on TTD's set. What do you think, Art?
Yeah, I think this is a signal that not everyone can build a walled garden. I think Roku wanted to build a walled garden, and to do that, you need inventory, you need data, and you need some sort of minimum scale. And maybe they found that they were a little bit too small to get people excited about using their OneView DSP, which was formerly DataXu. This is definitely a coup for the Trade Desk. I think there's a lot of vagueness. The press release was extremely vague. Leading into this, I had known about this for a while, and the rumors were OneView is going to be shut down, that you know, it was a deep partnership, and then the actual press release didn't say that, said nothing about OneView, and it was so vague that there were debates about what it actually said. Is this just private deals in the Trade Desk, or is it something more? I think we'll have to wait and see how impactful this actually is.
Yeah, it says specifically this: by leveraging Roku's ACR data, advertisers using the Trade Desk can suppress incremental households that have seen their linear TV ads, a capability advertisers have had directly with Roku, now available in an independent media buying platform on Roku.
Yeah, so that on Roku Media is like the caveat. So if it didn't say on Roku Media, I'd be really excited about this, because it would mean like you could use the Roku data on any media and then thereby get real reach extension. So one way to read this is like they're just going to create PMPs. They're per advertiser on Trade Desk that will just give you Roku media that hasn't been exposed to the linear ads. That's not that big a deal, really. I mean, it's nice, but that's not that groundbreaking.
Ari, did you do anything around the new fronts? Did you attend any presentations?
I did not. I was not invited. I don't have any budget. I don't have any budget. No one wants me at their events. When you said the EdTech Forum was last week, I was like, last week? I thought that was like a month or two ago. I don't know what's going on anymore.
Invite him to more parties. Take him out, everybody. All right, here's something new or something different. So article in The Verge, FCC fines AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon nearly $200 million for illegally sharing location data. The agency alleges the carriers illegally shared customers' location data with other companies without consent. And we'll put it in the newsletter for this week. But effectively, what the telecoms were doing, allegedly, was being hands-off on making the data available for marketing purposes by basically selling it to intermediaries. Having something buried in the language that allowed it, or maybe not, and that's why they're getting fined. Thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is interesting because it's the FCC, not the FTC.
Right.
Because the FTC doesn't really have the right to make this allegation because consent is not required in the United States to share data. Under GDPR, obviously, it is, and under certain state laws, it is. But the FCC has regulation over telecoms. And so this sort of answered a lot of questions I've had, which is over the past like 5 years, we've seen numerous privacy-related exposés about, I was able to follow women into abortion clinics, I was able to do this and that. And the question was always, where's the data coming from? And who are these data brokers, and where are they getting the data? And I think we all knew the telecoms were involved. But I think this suit really puts it out there. I'm, for one, very happy about this. I think location data should never be sold. I think it's too sensitive.
Yeah, it makes sense. Kim, are you doing anything differently, or either proactively or based on client requests around location data and sort of kind of hot button topics like this?
In some cases, we use location data, but it's rare. So I have a lot of strong beliefs around, privacy and things like that, especially when it comes to social media and all of those apps. So, for me, especially as I watch things like that Uber movie on Netflix, like super pumped, and how they were using location, like all that's so scary. And I know we're in this space and we're in the industry, but you always hope that people are doing the right thing. And so, for us, we don't try to necessarily push location data. We have some geofencing campaigns that we run here and there that are, or campaigns that are more dedicated to using location, but that's generally around something specific, a conference or, that kind of thing. Not, I'd like to say the cleaner things, not something that would be sensitive, around someone's health or things that are, should be more private.
Yeah, in the Uber book, Super Pumped, they talked about how Uber employees were tracking their girlfriends, how at parties they had a screen showing where celebrities were at the very moment. And that's not even a brokerage situation. That's just a one company using first-party data. Imagine that data gets out there, and it is out there, and what third parties can do, including government actors or malicious actors, it's really a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago with some state actors having access via ad tech companies.
No bueno.
Opposite of Super Pumped. Anyway, one more to close it out. And this is some pretty wonky ad tech stuff, but it seems to be interesting. So as part of the Google NewFronts announcements, and I heard that they presented for 2 hours, that it was a really big and sort of kind of lengthy presentation. They talked about Pair. Pair is publisher advertiser identity reconciliation. So yet another acronym. Seems like a collaboration tool. Seems like a clean room tool. Ultimately, they're partnering with the IAB to make it more broadly available because of cookies going away.
Yeah, it's a standard that Google created that allows publishers and advertisers to share identity information like hashed emails. It's hashed emails, basically. But there's one really important difference between this and the other hashed email concepts, which is that it is a pair. So only one advertiser with only one publisher, and that ID is useless to any other publisher. And I wrote about this kind of extensively in my newsletter back a couple of months ago, that strategically, this is a broadside against UID2, because UID2 has the advantage of being able to be used across publishers, across advertisers, and potentially for all kinds of uses. Even though it's more secure than emails, it's got some liquidity to it, whereas Pair does not have liquidity to it. And in a sense, you could definitely argue that this is a better solution, a better mousetrap for post-privacy, but I don't think it would make Jeff Green happy if this got adopted instead of UID2.
Yes, but this is also kind of shot across the bow at LiveRamp. Yeah. Because LiveRamp collaboration is basically the mantra for 2024.
Well, yes and no. So I think LiveRamp would prefer if their ramp ID was just the lingua franca, but they were very positive on Pair at their Ramp Up conference. They are full in on Pair as a way to get advertisers who use DV360 to use their ramp ID. It's one step forward, one step back for them. And so I think LiveRamp is pretty excited about Pair.
Got it. Okay. What would I do without you?
Well, as soon as you said it was a wonky subject, I was like stretching, getting ready.
On that note, let's call it out. All right, want to take
us home? This is a great episode. Kim, thank you so much for being here. This is a really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And Eric, always a pleasure.
Yep. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Thank you for subscribing to Marketecture. New interviews are added every week at marketecture.tv and your favorite podcasting app.